Geoffrey drew Nicholas aside and quickly gave him a resume of conditions in the country, particularly in the outlying areas. He is a little worried. He doesn't like the idea of you swanning around out there on your own. Lots of nasty men down there in the Gorjam. I told him that you knew how to look after yourself. In a remarkably short time, Waziro Tessai was back. I have cleared all your luggage, including the firearm and ammunition. This is your temporary permit. You must keep it with you at all times whilst you are in Ethiopia. Here are your passports. The visas are stamped and in order. Our flight to Lake Tana leaves in an hour, so we have plenty of time to check in. Any time you need a job, come and see me, Nicholas commended her efficiency. Geoffrey Tennant walked with them as far as the departures gate, where he shook hands. Anything I can do, it goes without saying. Serve to lead, Nicky. Serve to lead? Royan asked as they walked out to the waiting aircraft. Sandhurst's motto, he explained. How nice, Nicky, she murmured. I have always considered Nicholas to be more dignified and appropriate, he said. Yes, but Nicky is so sweet. In the high, thin air, the twin otter aircraft that took them on the last northern leg pitched and yawed in the updrafts from the mountains below. Although they were at 15,000 feet above sea level, the ground was close enough for them to make out the villages and the sparse areas of cultivation around them. Subjected for so many centuries to primitive agricultural methods and to the uncontrolled grazing of domestic herds, the land had a thin, impoverished look, and the bones of rock showed through the thin red fleshing of earth. Abruptly ahead of them, the plateau over which they were flying was rent through by a monstrous chasm. It was as though the earth had received a mighty sword stroke that struck through to her very bowels. The Abbe River, Tessé leaned forward in her seat to tap Royan's shoulder. The rim of the gorge was clear-cut, and then the slope dropped away at an angle of over 30 degrees. The bare plains of the plateau gave way immediately to the heavily forested walls of the gorge. They could make out the candelabra shapes of giant euphorbia rising above the dense jungle. In places, the walls had collapsed in scree slopes of loose rock, and in others, they were upthrust into bluffs and needles that erosion had sculpted with a monstrous artistry into the figures of towering humanoids and other fantastic creatures of stone. Down and down it plunged, and they winged out over the void until they could look directly down, a mile and more, onto the glittering snake of the river in the depths. The funnel shape of the upper walls formed a secondary rim as they reached the sheer cliffs of the sub-gorge 500 feet above the Nile water. Deep down there, between its terrible cliffs, the river gouged dark pools and long slithering runs through the red sandstone. In places, the gorge was 40 miles across. In others, it narrowed to under 10. But through all its length, the grandeur and desolation were infinite and eternal. Man had made no impression upon it. "You will soon be down there," Tessé told them in a voice so awed that it was almost a whisper. And they were both silent. Words seemed superfluous in the face of such raw and savage nature. Almost with relief, they watched the northern wall rise to meet them, and the high mountains of the Chouk range stood up against the tall blue African sky, higher than their fragile little craft was flying. The aircraft banked into its descent, and Tessé pointed over the starboard wingtip. Lake Tana, she told them. It was a wide and lovely body of water, over 50 miles long, studded with islands on each of which stood a monastery or an ancient church. As they dropped in over the water on the final approach, they could make out the white-robed priests plying between the islands on their traditional little boats made from bundles of papyrus. The otter touched down on the dirt strip beside the lake and rolled out in a long trailing cloud of dust. It swung in and stopped engines beside the run-down terminal building of thatch and daub. The sunlight was so bright that Nicholas pulled a pair of sunglasses from the breast pocket of his khaki jacket and placed them on his nose, as he stood at the top of the boarding ladder. He took in the pockmarks of bullets and shrapnel on the dirty white walls of the terminal and the burnt-out hull of a Russian T-35 battle tank standing in the grass on the verge of the runway. The barrel of its turret gun pointed earthwards, and grass had grown up between the rusted tracks. The other passengers pushed forward impatiently behind him, jostling him and jabbering with excitement, as they saw friends and relatives waiting to greet them under the eucalyptus trees that shaded the building. There was only one vehicle parked out there, a sand-coloured Toyota Land Cruiser. The roundel on the driver's door had, at its centre, the painted head of a mountain Nyala, with long corkscrew horns, and in a ribbon below it, the title, Wild Chase Safaris. A white man lounged behind the wheel. As Nicholas came down the ladder behind the two women, the driver slipped out of the truck and strode out onto the strip to meet them. He was dressed in a faded khaki bush suit, and he was tall and lean, and walked with a spring to his step. 40-ish, Nicholas judged his age from the grizzling in his short beard. One of the hard men, Nicholas thought. His ginger hair was cropped short. His eyes were pale killer blue. There was a puckered white scar that ran across one cheek and up to twist and deform his nose. Tessé introduced Royan to him first, and he made a short, choppy bow as he shook her hand. Enchanté, he told her in an execrable French accent, and then looked at Nicholas. This is my husband, Alto Boris, Tessé introduced him. Boris, this is Alto Nicholas. My English is bad, Boris said. My French is better. Not much to choose between them, Nicholas thought. But he smiled easily and said, So we will speak French then. Bonjour, Monsieur Brusilov. I am delighted to make your acquaintance. He offered the Russian his hand. Boris's grip was hard, too hard. He was making a contest out of the greeting. But Nicholas had expected it. He knew this type of old, and he had taken a deep grip so Boris could not crush his fingers. Nicholas held him without allowing any strain or effort to show on his lazy smile. Boris was the first to break the handshake, and there was just the trace of respect in those pale eyes. "So you have come for a dik-dik?" he asked, just short of a sneer. "Most of my clients come for Big Elephant, or at least for Mountain Nyala."
"Bit rich for my nerves," Nicholas grinned. "All that big stuff. Dik-dik will suit me fine."
"Have you ever been down in the gorge?" Boris demanded. His Russian accent overpowered the French words and made them difficult to follow.
"Sir Nicholas was one of the leaders of the 1976 river expedition," Royan intervened sweetly, and Nicholas was amused by her unexpected intervention. She had picked up the antagonism between them very quickly and come to his rescue. Boris grunted and turned to his wife.
"Have you got all the stores I ordered?" he demanded.
"Yes, Boris," she answered meekly. "They are all on board the aircraft." She is afraid of him, Nicholas decided. Probably with good reason.
"Let's get loaded up, then. We have a long journey ahead of us."
The two men rode in the front seats of the Toyota, and the women sat behind them with many of the packages of stores packed in around them. Good African protocol, Nicholas smiled to himself. Men first, women fend for themselves.
"You don't want to do the tourist run, do you?" Boris made it sound like a threat.
"The tourist run?"
"The outlet from the lake and the power station," he explained. "The Portuguese bridge over the gorge, and the point where the Blue Nile begins," he added. But before they could accept, he warned them, "If you do, we won't get into camp until long after dark."
"Thanks for the suggestion," Nicholas told him politely, "but I have seen it all before."
"Good," Boris made his approval evident. "Let's get out of here."
The road swung away into the west, below the high mountains. This was the Gojam, the land of the aloof mountaineers. It was well-populated country, and they passed many tall, thin men along the roadside as they strode along behind their herds of goats and sheep, with their long staffs held crossways over their shoulders. Both men and women wore shamas, woolen shawls, and baggy white jodhpur pants, with their feet in open sandals. They were people with proud and handsome features, their hair dressed out into thick, bushy halos, and their eyes fierce as those of eagles. Some of the younger women in the villages they passed through were truly beautiful. Most of the men were heavily armed. They carried two-handed swords in chased silver scabbards and AK-47 assault rifles.
"Makes them feel like big men," Boris chuckled. "Very brave. Very macho."
The huts in the villages were circular walled tuckles, surrounded by plantations of eucalyptus and spiky-headed sisal. Bruised purple storm clouds boiled over the high peaks of the choke and swept them with squalls of rain. Like silver coins, the huge drops rattled against the windscreen of the Land Cruiser and turned the road to a running river of mud under their wheels. The condition of the road surface was appalling. In places it deteriorated into a rocky gully, which even the four-wheel drive Toyota could not negotiate, and Boris was forced to make his own track across the rocky hillside. Often reduced to walking speed, they were nevertheless tossed about in their seats as the wheels bounced over the rough terrain.
"These damn blacks don't even think to repair their roads," Boris grunted. "They are happy to live like animals."
None of them replied, but Nicholas glanced into the rearview mirror at the faces of the two women. They were closed and neutral, hiding any hurt that either of them might have felt at the remark. As they went on, the road, bad as it had been originally, became even worse. From here onwards, the soft, muddy surface had been torn up by the tires and tracks of heavy traffic. "Military traffic?" Nicholas raised his voice above the buffeting rain squalls, and Boris grunted.
"Some of it. Ah, there is a lot of Shufta activity along the gorge. Bandits and dissident warlords. However, most of this traffic is mineral prospecting. One of the big mining companies has got concessions in Gojam, and they are moving in to begin drilling."
"We have passed no civilian vehicles," Royan remarked. "Not even public buses."
"We have just come through a terrible period in our long and troubled history," Tessa explained to her. "We are an agrarian-based economy. Once we were known as the breadbasket of Africa. But when Mengistu seized power, he drove us right over the edge of poverty. He used starvation as a political weapon. We are still suffering terribly. Very few of our people can afford the luxury of a motor vehicle. Most of them are worried how they will be able to afford food for their children."
"Tessé has an economics degree from Addis University," Boris chuckled.
"She is very clever. She knows everything. You ask her, she will tell you. History, religion, economics. Just ask her."
Tessé relapsed into silence at the rebuff. In the middle of the afternoon, the rain at least eased, and a timid sun peered through the cloud banks. Boris stopped the Toyota in a deserted stretch of countryside.
"Pinkelpaws," he announced. "Wee-wee stop. Pee-pee time."
The two girls left the truck and wandered away amongst the rocks. When they returned to the vehicle, they had changed their clothing. Both of them now wore the shamas and the jodhpur trousers of the country. "Tessé has made me a gift of traditional Tigrayan costume," said Royan, pirouetting for Nicholas' approval.
"Looks good, too," he gave his opinion. "You'll be a lot more comfortable in pants."